Hello, and welcome to the Audiobook Review. I am Jason Brown. On this show, I talk about mainly audiobooks, but I also talk about other facets of the publishing industry. I am honored to have as my guest today one of the top highly regarded professionals in the publishing industry. Not only does she have an above-average intelligence, if you don't mind my saying, but she's also a very, very nice person and extremely articulate. So this show is actually going to be in two segments, one this week and one next week, as she has so many good things to say. How she wandered into this studio is one of the wonders of the modern world. I love the Berkshires. It's a magical place. I welcome Becky Saladin to the Audio Book Review. Thank you for joining us.
Glad to be here.
What a treat. I'm going to read something I grabbed off the internet. Huffington Post, I believe, and some of it from the Washington Post. Saladin was the publisher of adult trade books at Harcourt before being promoted when Houghton Mifflin acquired Harcourt in 2007. She has also held positions at Yale University Press, Simon & Schuster, and Farrar, Straus, and Giroux, as well as Random House. This is from the Huffington Post. She is the best, quote-unquote, says literary agent Liz Darenzoff, who represents one of Saladin's authors, novelist Ivan Doig. Quote, she is a wonderful editor and a real hands-on publisher, responsive and a pleasure to work with, unquote. So this show, I'm focusing on the written published word. Audiobooks would not be without the book, of course. I've toyed around with direct audio material, but if you're going to go to the trouble of rewriting a book 20 times with the help of a brilliant editor, you might as well publish it, right?
Right.
So I thought it'd be interesting to get the brilliant editor's perspective on that. I know you must be brilliant. It's the last time I'll use that word. As Philip Roth would have nothing less, I'm sure. You worked with him recently on Indignation and something else.
I actually inherited Indignation when it was already in galley form, so I can't say I worked on it editorially, although I was involved with the publication. And I did sign up a new book for HMH, Houghton Mifflin Harcourt, which goes under the name The Humbling, which will come out next fall.
Oh, whoa, you heard it here.
And I did have the honor of providing editorial notes on that book.
We'll get to him later if I can wait that long. And I'll also play a 6-minute hysterical clip from the Indignation audio from Brilliance, read by Dick Hill. So, you ready for some questions, Becky?
I'm ready. As ready as I'll be.
So you've worked with some of the top publishing houses in the world. Obviously, everything in this country is being affected by the current economic situation. How do you think this is influencing the publishing industry?
Well, nobody quite knows yet, and everybody's uneasy because there seems to be a general consensus, if about nothing else, there seems to be a general consensus that the publishing world is not going to go back to being what it was, even assuming we're going to come out of our current economic predicament sometime in the hopefully not too distant future. And as I've been talking to people outside of the business, particularly over these holidays, actually, people have been asking me why that's so. I mean, why isn't it going to just go back to being what it was? And I realized I didn't quite know. But I think part of what's happened is there was a perfect storm, which seems to be the phrase that's on everybody's lips lately. Even before the economy took the downturn it's in right now, the election was tremendously distracting. We were all very afraid of, in publishing, all very afraid of this past fall because we knew that people were going to be highly distracted by this, you know, extremely important election. And even in the early fall, we could see that things were not going as they typically do. And this has been a tough year on top of what have been a string of increasingly tough years, up and down, depending where you are. I think there's a feeling that there's been a reckoning that's been a long time coming. I mean, the general way of understanding this is that the business has increasingly in the past, really over the past couple of decades, the time in which I've been in it, come to depend on big books, a couple of big books, usually on a list to pull everything else through. That's really how the business works economically. You hope to have a couple of things that really, you know, go into the stratosphere, and they pull through a lot of books, which frankly don't make money. Most books lose money. That's a fact of the business, and probably really has been a fact for a very long time.
Do you know the percentage?
I don't know the percentage, but figure that on an average list, let's say you're doing 30 new books in a season, 30 new hardcovers in a season on a sort of an average imprints list, whether that's the whole house or just one part of the house. Let's say if you have two books that really hit it and maybe another four or five or six books that do sort of moderately well, what we call a good solid mid-list performance, that's generally what a successful season looks like. So, you know, that's a reality that's hard to understand if you're outside of the business. But one of the problems has been that the book, the way publishing deals are structured, authors are paid in advance against royalties. So they're paid something up front that they don't have to give back. They're earning royalties against that amount. But if they don't ever earn out, which happens in the case of a lot of books, they don't have to give back the amount of the advance that didn't get earned out. And then they make royalties beyond that advance if the book earns out the advance. And the advances have gotten higher and higher for things that look like they have commercial possibilities. So I think what's happened is there's that element of how the business functions, the high advances, the preoccupation with other things, the advent of other forms of entertainment that are increasingly taking people's time, and a sense that this is all sort of a rickety structure that with very low margins for profitability, and then add in the factor that these companies are most of them owned by corporations now, which have in general, and this is a long-term problem in the business, they have in general expectations that the business can perform at a level that really it doesn't. The generally accepted figure is publishing can reliably, in decent times, turn maybe a 4 or 5% profit, not double digits. And corporations generally expect, or did expect up until recently, double-digit profits.
Is there any way of gauging which book will be the winner and which book will be the mid-list and which books will not do anything at all? I mean, of course, at this point, you're a professional and you have a pretty good sense, but is there a science at all?
No, the joke is that your corporate boss says to you, please, could you just publish, more bestsellers?
Oh, yeah.
And if we only knew. And actually, I've had the affinity or the good luck to work mostly with houses that see their big successes come often out of left field. And it's really worth bearing in mind. Usually when something really, really works, even for very commercially minded houses, Harry Potter famously got turned down all over the place. So did Lolita. So did, so did lots of things that have become classics or at least had good, solid commercial successes in the short term.
Did Harcourt turn down Harry Potter?
I don't know. I wasn't there then. I don't think so. But Harcourt did publish before my time. I can't take any credit. Published Life of Pi, a book that had been turned down all over the place. And who would have thought that odd book would become the smash hit that it did? And certainly, I've seen it happen on my own list. Some of my biggest successes have been books that started very small and that nobody thought would do what they did.
Giroux turned down On the Road, of course.
Yes.
The famous story.
Yes.
He didn't like The Scroll.
Yes. And was forced to turn down Salinger, not his choice.
I know. That was tough for him, I think.
It led to his going to FSG.
Well, what do you make of some of the current trends? Like there's texting, there's Twitter, the Kindle, or e-texts. You can download a book, of course, onto the Kindle. And this young Japanese girl just published this bestseller that consists of her compilation of her texting. I can't imagine reading something like that. Where do you think it's all going? What's happening there?
Well, this is one of the burning questions, and it's hard to know. I mean, if we could see it, we would sort of be in it already. That's one of the things about the future, that's very hard to predict. I'm not such a naysayer about things like the Kindle or ebooks in general. I don't think it's bad for new forms to take root. Actually, the biggest users of the Kindle so far, I think, are the people in the publishing business because everybody discovered and publishing houses discovered that it was going to be a lot more economical and save them lots on their health insurance for people's dislocated shoulders to have devices available that everybody could read manuscript submissions and proposals on rather than hauling around hundreds of pounds of paper with us, which is what we used to do.
Are there enough people in the publishing business to support a new product?
But once you start to use these devices, you can see what their appeal is. It's very attractive to go on a trip and have. I had War and Peace on my Kindle, 1,500 pages that I could haul around with me on the subway and read in snatches rather than taking that lovely, beautifully designed but very heavy volume around with me. Mm-hmm. So I don't think these devices in themselves are a bad thing. I think the tricky thing is making sure that the content continues to be something that is of quality and that people's appetite for quality is not stunted because somebody's text message installments become sort of the standard, then we're really in trouble because where's the role of the editor or the publisher in that? There is a role for an editor and a publisher in ebooks. Something has to make those so good that people want to read them, want to make audiobooks of them. Something has to get them into that kind of shape. But I don't think it's a bad thing in itself for new forms of expression to spring up. That's happened over time, and we can see that the literary world has evolved. I got to see Norman Mailer in one of his very last public appearances with Günter Grass at the New York Public Library. I guess that's about a year and a half ago, and maybe 2 years now. And he, reminded us of the fact that people are not writing plays in iambic pentameter anymore. Forms do change, and physical forms do change.
Well, I think in 10 years, Philip Roth is going to be texting in his books from his BlackBerry.
Philip Roth and I actually talked about the fact that we're both Luddites and we hate new technology.
But I noticed you had a Kindle, though.
I had a Kindle because it was given to me.
Oh, okay.
I would have been a late adopter, but I was an early adopter because I was given one by my company.
It was forced upon you.
It was forced upon me, but I quickly became a convert. I could see the appeal, but I still kept buying books, too.
I love books. I mean, the smell of the new pages. That was in my first audiobook.
Still, I remember a moment, when CDs first came into being, and I was with a friend, and he was a book friend, actually, and he said, but albums are never going to completely go away, vinyl meaning vinyl, because they have such charm. And I think,
Charm.
Somehow charm didn't keep vinyl alive, so we'll see about paper books.
Yeah, well, vinyl's pretty big right now, so...
I guess so.
Some stores sell exclusively vinyl. It's incredible. People like the old stuff, So I think... books are here to stay forever and ever.
But new vinyl pressings are not made, right?
Right.
When an album comes
out. Oh, there
are. Are they?
Oh, yeah.
Oh,
especially sometimes exclusively. So what is the editor's job? I think a lot of people take it for granted. Oh, you're an editor. Oh, yeah, you go through a manuscript and you cross that word out. And in your mind, what is an editor's job? I'd love to hear you describe what an editor does.
Well, I think you have the stereotype down. I mean, it's sitting there with your green visor or in your, wingback chair or whatever. Well, the stereotype is, sitting there putting the few final commas in the masterpiece. I think a lot of people don't seem to actually know that choice is involved. That's the first thing, is to find – basically, that's the job. Find good stuff and publish it. And then there's a kind of a parallel track. There's the work on the book itself, which is the heart of editing, which means figuring out how to get the book from its early stages, if you've bought it on proposal or if it's already a full manuscript. Nonfiction tends to get bought on the basis of proposals, meaning maybe a couple of chapters, an outline, a synopsis, some information about the author, and so on. Fiction typically gets bought on the basis of a full manuscript, but it still may need extensive revising. But there's a back and forth, and you never expect that an author is going to take all of your suggestions. And I also am a very firm believer that there's always multiple ways of solving editorial problems. But there's a back and forth until finally you have a manuscript that you and the author feel is essentially done. Other people will follow. A copy editor will come and, correct the grammar and point out that the character who died on page 163 has miraculously sprung back to life on 282. or as once happened for the writer I was working with, George Packer, actually a local Berkshire author who I had the pleasure of editing years ago, that a refrigerator had was suddenly humming in the background, but the power had gone out earlier in the scene.
Oh, continuity.
That's right, continuity issues. So those kinds of things will still get fixed, and it's important that other eyes, fresh eyes, look at the book there, and a proofreader proofread it to make sure, once it's in galley stage, that everything is as it should be, and it goes on through. But there's another process that happens along with the editing process, which is the kind of selling process, which editors are actually key in almost in every publishing structure that I'm aware of. And that's a process that begins in-house, where the books are kind of traveling with other books that are being published in a season. Usually begins with something called a launch meeting, where an editor is presenting books to the internal staff of the house, meaning the key people in sales, marketing, publicity, often design and production as well. Everybody in the house is hearing what the list is going to be for the first time. And it's an incredibly important moment because it's the beginning of the process of selling the book both internally and onto the outside world. And usually what happens at that moment is the editor pitches the book or launches the book, we usually like to say. And you don't get more than a couple of minutes to do that. But the way in which you present the book, which is not only describing it, but it's beginning to give everybody else in the publishing house a sense of how to get across the appeal of the book. Who is it for? Why would they want to read it? In a very short space. And it's a fun process. It's actually a creative process in its own right. It's figuring out how to hook somebody's attention and make them think that they're going to want to read it. And everybody takes their cue from that. Editors don't always do a great job of that, which means that the work is on for the publicity people and marketing and sales to come up with their own better ways, and they have to do that anyway, of positioning the book.
You're listening to WBCR LP Great Barrington 97.7 FM. We are speaking with editor and publisher Becky Saladin. We're going to take a quick break for a public service announcement that promotes the cause of reading and listening and using libraries.
Hi, this is Nelson DeMille. Nothing is more relaxing than getting lost in an audiobook that lets my ears turn the pages. I enjoy listening in a dark, quiet room with a glass of wine in my hand. An audiobook is like having a great storyteller in the room with you, and I don't have to share the wine. This is Nelson DeMille. A good audiobook speaks for itself. Get caught listening.
So what was it like working with some of the giants of modern fiction, such as Philip Roth, that we've been talking about?
Roth, of course, was an incredible honor, and it was my good luck. I can't say I've had the pleasure. I wish I'd had the pleasure to work with him for a very long time, but I stepped into the lucky position of getting to work with him when I became publisher of Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. Roth has been a longtime Houghton Mifflin author. And I did, as I say, have the great honor to see through Indignation and also to begin to work with him on The Humbling. And I actually had an editorial conversation with him, which he came to with a tape recorder and asked if he could tape record me because he said he didn't want to take notes because it would distract him. And I was able to raise a few questions about certain characters' relationships. That's the fun of editing fiction, is getting to talk about motivation and would this character do that or not, or are the reader's sympathies sufficiently engaged, or is it believable that such and such a thing would happen, or about pacing and so on. It's quite different editing fiction from editing nonfiction.
Right now I'm going to play a 6-minute excerpt from Indignation, Philip Roth's latest book.
And lessons I loved. Bring them on. And I love my father, and he me, more than ever before in our lives. In the store, I prepared our lunch, his and mine. Not only did we eat our lunch there, but we cooked our lunch there, on a small grill in the back room, right next to where we cut up and prepared the meat. I'd grill chicken livers for us. I'd grill little flank steaks for us. And never were we two happier together. Yet only shortly afterward the destructive struggle between us began. Where were you? Why weren't you home? How do I know where you are when you go out? You are a boy with a magnificent future before you. How do I know you're not going to places where you can get yourself killed? During that fall, I began Robert Treat as a freshman. Whenever my father double-locked our front and back doors, and I couldn't use my keys to open either, and I had to pound on one or the other door to be let in if I came home at night 20 minutes later than he thought I ought to, I believed he had gone crazy. And he had. Crazy with worry that his cherished only child was as unprepared for the hazards of life as anyone else entering manhood. Crazy with the frightening discovery that a little boy grows up, grows tall, overshadows his parents, and that you can't keep him then, that you have to relinquish him to the world. I left Robert Treat after only 1 year. I left because suddenly my father had no faith, even in my ability to cross the street by myself. I left because my father's surveillance had become insufferable. The prospect of my independence made this otherwise even-tempered man, who only rarely blew up at anyone, appear as if he were intent on committing violence should I dare to let him down, while I, whose skills as a cool-headed logician had made me the mainstay of the high school debating team, was reduced to howling with frustration in the face of his ignorance and irrationality. I had to get away from him before I killed him, so I wildly told my distraught mother, who now found herself as unexpectedly without influence over him as I was. One night, I got home on the bus from downtown about 9:30. I'd been at the main branch of the Newark Public Library, as Robert Treat had no library of its own. I had left the house at 8:30 that morning and been away attending classes and studying, and the first thing my mother said was, "Your father's out looking for you." "Why? Where is he looking?" "He went to a pool hall." "I don't even know how to shoot pool. What is he thinking about? I was studying, for God's sake. I was writing a paper. I was reading. What else does he think I do night and day?" "He was talking to Mr. Pearlgreen about Eddie, and it got him all riled up about you." Eddie Pearlgreen, whose father was our plumber, had graduated from high school with me and gone on to college at Panzer in East Orange to learn to become a high school phys ed teacher. I had played ball with him since I was a kid. "I'm not Eddie Pearlgreen," I said. "I'm me." But do you know what he did? Without telling anybody, he drove all the way to Pennsylvania, to Scranton, in his father's car to play pool in some kind of special pool hall there. "But Eddie's a pool shark. I'm not surprised he went to Scranton. Eddie can't brush his teeth in the morning without thinking about pool. I wouldn't be surprised if he went to the moon to play pool. Eddie pretends with guys who don't know him that he's only at their level of skill, and then they play and he beats the pants off them for as much as $25 a game." "He'll end up stealing cars," Mr. Pearlgreen said. "Oh, Mother, this is ridiculous. Whatever Eddie does has no bearing on me. Will I end up stealing cars?" "Of course not, darling. I don't like this game Eddie likes. I don't like the atmosphere he likes. I'm not interested in the low life, Ma. I'm interested in things that matter. I wouldn't so much as stick my head in a pool hall." "Oh, look, this is as far as I go explaining what I am and am not like. I will not explain myself one more time. I will not make an inventory of my attributes for people or mention my goddamn sense of duty. I will not take one more round of his ridiculous, nonsensical crap." Whereupon, as though following a stage direction, my father entered the house through the back door, still all charged up, reeking of cigarette smoke, and angry now, not because he'd found me in a pool hall, but because he hadn't found me there. It wouldn't have dawned on him to go downtown and look for me at the public library, the reason being that you can't get cracked over the head with a pool cue at the library for being a pool shark, or have someone pull a knife on you because you are sitting there reading a chapter assigned from Gibbon's Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, as I've been doing since 6 that night. "So there you are," he announced. "Yeah, strange, isn't it? At home. I sleep here. I live here. I am your son, remember?"
"Are you? I've been everywhere looking for you."
"Why? Why? Somebody please tell me why everywhere?"
"Because if anything were to happen to you, if something were ever to happen to you..."
"But nothing will happen, Dad. I am not this
terror of the earth who plays pool, Eddie Pearl Green. Nothing is going to happen. I know that you're not him, for God's sake. I know better than anybody that I'm lucky with my boy. Then what is this all about, Dad? It's about life, where the tiniest misstep can have tragic consequences. Oh, Christ, you sound like a fortune cookie. Do I? Do I? Not like a concerned father, but like a fortune cookie. That's what I sound like when I'm talking to my son about the future he has ahead of him, which any little thing could destroy, the tiniest thing. Oh, the hell with it, I cried, and ran out of the house, wondering where I could find a car to steal to go to Scranton to play pool and maybe pick up the clap on the side.
Is it me or is that Philip Roth at his funniest? I also heard shades of Nathan Zuckerman in the tension with the overly concerned father, or is it the reoccurring Oedipal battle that keeps surfacing in his novels? The parent discovering that the number one son thinks outside the box and having that be a threatening element.
Yeah, it's funny. First of all, playing the excerpt really is a wonderful advertisement for audiobooks themselves, because the reading so much brings up the humor in the scene. It's not actually the scene that I would have thought about when I, for me, there's a tour de force scene, as you know, between Marcus and the dean of the college he ends up going to, not where he's going to night school, but later on. And I won't ruin it for any readers who haven't had the pleasure of reading the book yet, but it's just, the scene just goes places and it keeps going and going. And it's just a tour de force and hilarious. So the scene that you picked is not the one I actually would have gone toward, and I didn't remember it being as funny as it is. Yeah. But of course, as you learn when you read the book, and again, without any spoilers, the father is correct about the tiniest missteps. And for me, what stays with me about that father-son tension in the book is, from the beginning, it's one of those missteps he has. I mean, it's not even a misstep. His father, for absolutely no good reason, has this idea about him, and it drives everything that follows. Yeah. And it's horrifying because he can't escape it. And I think it's a little different. Maybe I'm not the absolute Roth scholar I wish I were. So I don't want to make any absolute statements about how it does or doesn't compare to those other Oedipal situations that you refer to. But it seems a little different to me in that and this is one of the masterful things about Roth as a writer. In a sense, it's unmotivated. I mean, why does his father have this? And this is the kind of lack of motivation that you can get away with as a writer. What's so brilliant to me about the construction of that relationship is that the father does, for sort of no good reason, develop this ridiculous idea about his son, which ends up driving his son away into the college where other things happen. And he pulls off that relationship with such authority that you absolutely believe it, even though it's quote-unquote unmotivated. And, in the hands of a lesser writer, an editor might say, hey, you got to fix this father-son relationship. There's no good reason for the father to feel that way about him, but we totally buy it.
The amazing thing is it's so close. It's like it happened to you.
Yes.
Or it is happening to you. How does he do that? He just draws you right
genius.
Into the prose.
That's genius. And absolute conviction. Absolute conviction in what you're writing and how you're writing it and getting it across. The reader absolutely gets on board.
Yeah. Maybe one word would throw all that off. I mean, he's so precise. I wonder if it's the editor's job also to get rid of those words. And how do they know? But the effect is so extraordinary,
I
think.
Where a writer has a really strong voice and a really strong vision and a really strong sense of conviction, I think really all you are looking for sometimes is where do they lose it? Where is their misstep? Where is there a trite, line or something where that seems to flag? With the best writers, that's what you're doing. You're just saying, here, you fell off the horse for a second here, or you don't need this. We get it. You're absolutely on track. Trust yourself. Don't spell that out for the reader. We totally are there. Yeah, I mean, that's when it's sort of its most fun.
We're about out of time. Join us next week, and we will continue this discussion with Becky Salatan. It's just been so much fun speaking with her. This has been the Audiobook Review. I've been your host, Jason Brown. See you at the next show.